You want to work with good people.
Oh my gosh, whenever
you have
yes.
the opportunity to surround yourself with good people, do that. Again, it helps with the cutting out of the bullshit kind of stuff.
This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Brock Rahm and Garrett Wright.
Molly, I'm Garrett. I do like human interest type stories. I do a little more of the, you know, kind of project management, hiring crews, all that.
Molly Wilkie has led highly effective teams creating disruptive integrated marketing campaigns for high-end brands like Whole Foods and the NFL. She is now the Senior Creative Director for Nerf and Sports Action with Hasbro. She likes smart design, bad puns, and sexy type. As for her dislikes, we'll get to that in a minute.
Justin, time that is?
Yeah. Go for it. I'll start this record.
Okay.
All right, I'm recording. You call
it.
All
right, shot. You want to do 55? Are you there yet?
I'm there. Let's do it.
All right. All right, we are synced.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack, so if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Joining us today is Molly Wilkie. She's the Senior Creative Director on Nerf and Sports Action at Hasbro, but has a very steeped background and strong design aesthetic from her time at the NFL and in the agency world. So, Molly, first and foremost, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to actually start, because when I was on your site, you have a list of likes and dislikes. And
going right in there. Huh?
I'm just jumping right in. It's very interesting, because in your dislikes, it's bad design, laziness, bullies, and crayons. I'm interested in understanding why you dislike crayons, especially as a creative director.
Yeah, right. You would think I would be playing with them all the time. Yeah, I have like an aversion, a very odd aversion to crayons. And I think it comes from like memories of childhood. The smell gets me every time, but it's like when they're broken in pieces and the paper's tearing and they're like thrown in a basket together and they're all writing all over each other. And I don't know if it's, maybe it's because of my creative director sensibilities where I like things kind of neat and clean and organized. It's they freak me out. So there's that.
So when you're doing your work today, do you work a lot in analog, or do you work a lot more in digital, on the apps and some of those kinds of things?
Yeah. I have my huge notebook here, that, you know, podcast can't see, but, I do a lot in analog, and I honestly probably write more than I draw at this point. Regardless, they're like precious little presents that I keep forever and ever, which I think my husband would like to throw out, but, they're just, it's like all the thoughts in your brain and the visuals or the nuggets of information that you have. I write everything down, and I am particular, not only about crayons, but, about like my pens and things like that. There's just a very, you want to take care of that, those thoughts and those ideas in really kind of precious ways and get them down so that you have them. And that the thinking, I guess, being that you can go back to them at any time, but, being the creative genius that I am, I have no idea what a lot of this is and, the thinking, but I try and organize it, and it's just helpful to get it out and put it on paper first. And then once you've got something kind of formulated, I can get to the computer to get things down.
So in your role at Hasbro, can you just kind of take us through what that looks like as far as, you know, day to day? You mentioned you're doing a lot more maybe writings and big picture ideas. Is that kind of what I gather? Or, I mean, how much are you hands on with some of this, and how much is it more managing a team and managing, you know, the ideas and the process of the team?
Right now, and it's to be fair, like 3 months in, so I haven't been there too long yet, but it's more managing the team, really getting an understanding of how they function, how the larger team functions, how Hasbro functions. And then figuring out where I can bring sort of my thinking to the table to kind of help the processes and the ultimate and design results, which includes branding for products, but also thinking larger to more franchise type pieces, and then design and packaging for all of those pieces as well. And whether that's regular kind of core mainline stuff or special limited items and what have you, there's a different scale, but thinking through how all of those things come to life and who are all the different players in the group, and making sure that we as a creative team are seen as not just folks who come in and kind of make things look pretty, which is I hate, but that we come in with a strong point of view and have an opinion and strategy behind the branding work that we do. And whether that's a mark that goes holistically on a project and then, you know, e-com and retail and what have you, or and then packaging, or if it's, you know, any of those pieces, that's thought through all the way along, and that there's specific strategies that we have set up in terms of briefs and things like that. So we're thinking through holistically what all these pieces are.
Why is it that you hate to only be the people that make things look pretty?
I think, I need to say this right. I think creatives who fight for cool just for the sake of cool are doing themselves and other creatives a serious injustice. And that when you make things cool for a reason and that there's meaning behind it, now you're giving yourself and the creative community more. There should be, one of the questions you had, I think, was what kind of value do you bring to the business? And it's a great question because it's always thinking about the business. You're doing this for a company, for a larger corporation. And, you know, as much as you might hate kind of the grind of that, it's the reality and that's the paycheck, and it keeps the lights on both at the company and in your own home. And you have to think about what's going to help that business. It's not just about what's the coolest thing. So if you're thinking through the reasonings and the right answers and really problem solving, then, and still being cool, now you've hit the pinnacle. It's not school anymore. You can't just make cool things for the sake of making cool things.
How do you achieve that? Because I mean, it's one thing to say, but I mean, how do you, and you kind of talked about, you know, in that first answer, you know, not being cool for the sake of being cool, but also, you know, making sure your voice is heard beyond mm-hmm. just that creative realm. As a leader, how do you go about, you know, getting that authority, getting that, maybe not confidence, but just the confidence of the groups you're in to not just be, you know, the place to come to make something cool, that you have a voice and thoughts about the brand and everything holistically?
I think it's starting from like the 30,000 feet, really thinking broadly initially and thinking about who are all the stakeholders and players involved and what's going to benefit all of them. I'm a big brief writer, and for me, it can be as simple as like the who, what, where, when, how, why, and then data. If you have any of the background information that really feeds into what you're trying to do, you know, say what you want about data, it can be formulated to fit whatever piece that's needed. But if it's there and it's speaking to the consumers you want to speak to, or it's saying like, you know, we know that this sells because of X, Y, and Z, you bring that forward. You're putting thought into it. It's not just here's something pretty or something cool and everybody oohs and ahs. People can ooh and ah, but it has no meaning. Or on the flip side, you could create something that probably has a lot of meaning, but might not aesthetically be pleasing. And so you want to find that balance there. And for me as a creative director, it's about having my team think through why something works and sort of proving it out and also presenting it in that way so that you do get kind of not necessarily the credit, but it's you're able to explain yourself and take folks on the journey of here was the problem, here's the solution and why we solved it in that way. And most people are pretty thankful for that sort of insight. And so it's, and being a creative, you bring things to the table that not everybody else really has the ability to do. So I think you hear that a lot, like, you know, I'm not a creative and I would never be able to design that. So now you're combining that thought and the problem solving and the thinking with the aesthetic solution. And I think that's pretty invaluable.
So in your role, you talk a lot about writing a lot more now. Can you take us back to the beginning of what got you interested? Have you wanted to work in sports, and how did you get your foot in the door to work in sports?
Sure. No, is the answer. It was never necessarily an intention. It sort of happened. And I'm thankful for it. I spent the 10 years at the NFL, and now I'm at NERF, where we're looking to grow into more of a lifestyle and sort of sports oriented brand, and or more so of a sports oriented brand. But I was never like, oh, I really want to work in sports. I have been a sports fan and an athlete, I think maybe my whole life, but it never occurred to me that that was a niche for me in the design world. I was working at agencies. I spent some time at Whole Foods. I definitely had more of like a feminine aesthetic to the work that I was doing. And I was freelancing. And one of the headhunters reached out, the NFL wants to talk to you. I was like, okay, but why, you know? And totally honest, at one point when I was talking to who would be my future boss at the NFL, and he was part of the interview, I was like, why are you interested in me? Because my work was just not, I wouldn't call it bold or sort of athletic or any of the sort of exciting verbiage you would put with sports design was not where I was. I was more organic and softer and lighter and prettier maybe. And I think to his credit, and for anybody who in the design world, like good design can transcend whatever platform or genre you want to work in. And, you know, there was a learning curve when I started the NFL to really try and get into like, okay, how do I shift my design aesthetic? Or can I incorporate some of that into a more sports, air quotes, right, sports looking design to bring that to life in a way that's unique to me and perhaps maybe somewhat disruptive or somewhat different than it was before. So no, I had no intention of getting into sports, but it happened and it was great. And it continues to, you know, just learning everything there is to know about, especially, you know, football, NFL football, the present, the past, the future, like there's always something to think about. And it's a constant education and a constant challenge and really kind of great. So very thankful for it.
I mean, what did you take away from those differences when you first walked into the NFL? I mean, how did you, you know, start to process the differences and the things that they, you know, we're going to want as a brand versus, you know, maybe some of those, you know, the different feel from the projects you had been working on in the past when you first got there. I mean, what was that process of kind of learning and adapting like?
You know, I'll start with there are so many projects in working in the creative team at the NFL that like, I don't even know that I started on a fully like football and I, again, air quotes, project for a little bit. One of the first things that I worked on at the NFL was we were finishing our lease at our old space and moving to a new location, you know, a couple blocks away, but we were designing the space. And they were like, we need to design the wall where we display the Super Bowl rings. And I have had an advertising background at that point and a little bit, you know, somewhat more design based, but I had been doing freelance and working on academics and Whole Foods and things like that. And I was like, yeah, sure. I'll design a wall where we display all the Super Bowl rings from like the past 40 years or whatever. And I was like, okay. I guess I'll say out loud, like it's fake it till you make it. But I was like, well, I mean, I'm not crafting them out of my bare hands, but I'm designing what we think that would look like and how that would come to life. And that's probably was like the easiest jump in terms of an aesthetic, like let's display jewelry. Like, okay, I'm into that. I can do that, but it was still in the world of sports. And that translated into another project. And it was a lot of it was decor around that space and the style. Yeah. But you're grabbing images. You know, we had access to AP images for a lot of the player imagery and everything. And you're using great photography and huge personalities and taking that and bringing that to life with graphics and typography. And it's just, it's more storytelling than it is necessarily like a design aesthetic. And so that was a easier kind of way to see it. So it wasn't so much of a jump.
When you talk about the design aesthetic and wanting to make sure that people and your team approaches and brings more to the table than just making it look good and marrying all of that together.
Right.
Are there any tips or things that helped you get to that point where, because I do think, especially when you're coming out of school, that a lot of people probably start with the aesthetics. And do you feel like, is there anything that you felt like helped you pull along and make the connection, I guess, the best way to phrase that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go back to the sort of brief idea. And for me, I preach this to my team a lot now too, is like, let's make sure we're all on the same page up front. So as creatives, we have room to sort of grow and ebb and flow within that objective. So I think it's starting with a really clear idea of what is the problem we're trying to solve and where do we sort of, it can be somewhat broad or rough, but like, where do we want to be at the end? The tone, or how are we going to do that? And if, like, you know, one nugget, like what's the key, what's that North Star that you're going to put at the top of every page or every sketch page or whatever that you're going to use, is like, is it doing that? And then moving forward, right? As long as you're hitting that bar and accomplishing that thing, then you could kind of create anything. And that's where I find it easier to think outside the box when the box is smaller, if that makes sense, right? Like if you give yourself room to work in, you can go broader. If you leave it totally open, then you're like, where do I go? It's, you know, just having some idea and some frame of reference of what you're trying to accomplish and how you're going to accomplish it, what's going to make everybody happy at the end, then you have room to work.
Do you have a process, whether through ideation or any other ways of approaching that, to get to the point where you're putting that one word across the top? How do you get to the point where you're all on the same page to put that one word across the top after you get the brief?
I guess it's truly, it kind of depends on each project, yeah, right? But, you know, what problem are we trying to solve? And if it's just like, how are we going to sell blasters to adults? I don't know. There's more to it than that. And you kind of have to dig in deeper. If it's just trying to, you know, what's the best way to set up decor for Super Bowl in Miami after we've been through X, Y? It's a good question to think through it a little more. I'm trying to think. It's really just writing out. If you can sit down and answer, like, what is the, you need context, right? What's the background? Where have we been with this? What do we know about it so far? And then what are we trying to solve for? And how are we trying to put that out there in the world, right? What's the tone? What's the voice? What's the style? Is this something that should be like super didactic and in your face, and we're going to tell you exactly how it is? Is this something that's more fun and exciting and goofy, or is it something that's really like calm and serene, whatever? Like, you have different areas to fall in, but really, what are we trying to solve for, I think, is the main piece that I think I want everybody on the same page with before anybody starts anything.
I want to kind of jump at you. The question there was a little about early in your career and how you developed that process. But, you know, I want to even go back further. It's kind of your agency life and your time there. You know, I think in sports, a lot of people that we know tend to work a little bit more directly with the teams or leagues, much like you did with the NFL, but don't have that agency experience. You know, how would you describe the difference between working in an agency early in your career and, you know, working directly with a team or league or, you know, in-house, basically?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, I think the main thing is less of a difference and more like, what is how can we help the business in this? It's interesting being on the brand side, because you do have one main client and you're immersed in that. There are obviously different arms of it. Clearly with the NFL, it's like every department is a client. With Nerf, it's like every product is a client. So, you know, I do think that the main purpose for both is going to be the business side of things, right? You still have to find something, an execution, no matter how creative, that still works for the business. But, you know, when you're in-house, you have a a main focus. You're really immersed in that brand and you know it top to bottom. And it's, I'd say, having been on the both sides and being on the brand side and watching agencies work, sometimes it's hard to let them be the expert on things because you're living in that world day in and day out of that brand. You do what you can to try and find the, give them the space to run and go crazy, but still giving them the information they need to focus on what's important for your brand. But it's nice to step away too. And I think that's, this is maybe a little off topic, but something that's great about my role at NERF now is kind of being the new person at the table who has an outside point of view, where people can get really stuck in, this is, I would say, something from the brand side, you can get really stuck and very esoteric in your own sort of brand situation that you don't even, you're not thinking like a consumer or a fan. You're stuck in the marketing ease. You're stuck in the acronyms and everything that you use within the four walls of that business. And that's not a great place to be when you're talking to other people. Right. And I think agencies have the ability to tap into that a little bit better. So there's, you know, pros and cons to both sides.
How often, you know, do you bring in outside agencies when you're working in house, you know, at an NFL or a Hasbro, and why would you choose to do that on your end as opposed to trying to handle that all in house?
Yeah, sometimes, I mean, especially with the NFL, and I'm starting to see it more at NERF too, but you just don't have the bandwidth, and it's nice to either the bandwidth or perhaps the talent. And I'm not trying to say that the people in-house don't have talent. It's just a matter of like, okay, we're focusing on something that we've never really tried before or something different. You may want to have try your hand at it, but in sort of a high stakes business like the NFL or something like that, you want to bring in experts, and you want to bring somebody to the table who maybe don't do what you do, and you want their input. You want them to take over. And I'd say from like an agency side, it's when you start with the kernel of an idea and put it together into an ad campaign, but you're bringing in a director or a photographer or something like that. You want them to bring different things to the table. And that's what I would want from a brand side of things when looking for an external agency. Like what can they bring to the table that we're not seeing and we're not doing? And also just bandwidth. It's like, we can't take this on right now. I'm in no position to say yes to this because it's going to make all the other work sacrifice. And that's a luxury. You have to have the budgets to be able to do something like that. But it's also nice to know when to say no and when you've hit your limits. And it's like, we're, all of our other work will suffer, or, you know, we'll take this on and that can be prioritized, but this will fall by the wayside and it'll get done, but we just won't have the bandwidth to really hit it the way we'd like to.
When you have tight timelines, how do you still find time, or do you still find time to explore and try some new things as a group?
It's difficult, but I think my team at the NFL was great. I've lucked out with sort of the team I've been given at NERF. They're the folks who are super creative and are always digging into new things and new ideas, and they find time for it. I don't think I've ever been in a position where like forced it on anyone, like, oh, we got to go learn about this, or we got to learn about that. There's usually somebody who's like, oh, I just saw this new thing or this new thing. I try and make sure that would I love to sit around and read articles about new things all day long? Absolutely. But trying to hit, headlines here and there and dig into something that is interesting and then share it with the group. And if they want to dig into it, great. But at least it's sort of a top line, like, here's some cool thinking, here's things we haven't done or could do or whatever. I'm a big believer of sharing any sort of ideas that you have and putting it out to the group or what have you. And so I would do that at the NFL. I do that now with my team at NERF, and they hadn't really had much, it sounds, you know, obvious, but much interaction over the pandemic. And when I started, I sort of initiated a daily meeting, for better, for worse. It was like, we gotta start talking to one another. And like, they had missed it so much. And now they're sharing the work that they're doing or new things or thoughts on Netflix series or whatever, but at least they're sharing. And I think the more that you can do that, just the more things open up. So I think you know, you make time for the things you want to make time for. And then there are some things that you don't even realize you're doing it, but it's just your sort of innate passion. You're finding it and just kind of listening to what other people are saying too might spark interest to find time for other things as well.
I love that idea of the daily meeting, because I think that's, you know, one thing that everyone talks about, even as the possibility of return to office for places comes back, is just that water cooler interaction, those kind of things are, especially for a creative industry, is tough. And I think coming up, you know, just even having that daily meeting is important. But, you know, for you as a leader, you know, I feel like that's a great example of leadership and just coming up with a way. You know, how have you developed your skills as a leader over the years? Because looking at your resume, it seems like, you know, each step for you has come with more management and more leadership. And how have you, you know, just developed that skill set? Because it's a very different skill set than just being creative to manage people. Right.
You know, I think you learn a lot from every role, right? Like I've been increasing and that's been great, but you experience different people and different personalities and different bosses or bosses' bosses or what have you along the way. And you learn things that you want to emulate. You learn things that you don't want to do, right? And that's like, well, I'm never going to be a leader like that. And kind of find your way. And I feel like I can say that I'm pretty empathetic and good at listening to people. And to me, that's one of like the baseline things you need as a leader, is just to be able to listen and hear other people. And whether it's personal thing or a work thing or whatever, that you're hearing them and they feel heard, right? So starting there, and then, you know, being able to say no and organizing projects and things like that. I have, I really love efficiency. I think that was in one of my likes. And I really dislike bullshit, and as much as I can dish it, but I just, those two things together and me being sort of a loudmouth and not afraid to speak my mind helps kind of cut through some of the excess whatever that's out there, and maybe just by default puts me at the front of the front lines of taking heat, answering questions, being somebody people come to. So I think that's just sort of grown over the years. But also I've learned, like, you really have to be clear about, you may not know exactly what you want in terms of, you know, just being a creative director and looking for your team to bring things to you, but here's a general idea, or setting the expectations of, I kind of want something, but it needs to be in this, again, in this box. Setting the expectations and being clear about timelines and things like that, so that they can go off and work independently and feel like they have access to you for questions. But that, you know, I don't want to hold hands. I don't want to micromanage. I don't think anybody else really wants to be handheld or micromanaged. So empowering them to go off and do their thing, but within sort of guardrails. It's just sort of ends up being like the work that I do also, you know, we're putting out style guides and things like that for, folks who are not working for you, who to utilize and bring your vision to life. You need to give them the rules within which to work, but still freedom to create within those.
Thought you might jump in there, Justin. I know leadership and management, that's one of your favorite topics, my guy.
I know, but it can't always be me, right? I got to share the floor here.
Exactly. No, I just thought, I love that answer. I think you nailed all the skills that you have to have, and it's really cool to see those develop over a course of a career. And I mean, how do you, you know, maybe jumping on the back of that is just even then, how do you develop leaders underneath you as a manager, right? How do you get people to grow that skill set? Because a lot of times, again, it's, you know, managers come from creative people that maybe don't manage well. Like, creatives get rewarded for being good creatives. So how do you develop that skills in people below you to manage well when you're a manager?
I don't know how much you can teach sort of the soft skills. I mean, you could put it out there, but sort of depends on the person. And then it's really that sort of strategic and meaningful thinking of building briefs and sitting there and sort of proving, I don't know, proving is the right word, but giving credence to all the work that you've done and being able to take people on that journey and tell that story. And that's something I think you can teach a little bit better. And teaching them, like, hey, you can't just say, I need you to go do this and wait and respond to 10 things when they bring it back. You know, that's, again, that's an inefficiency. That's a waste of time. we've got to make sure that you've set up expectations. Here's what I'm looking for. You don't want to draw it out for them. I would, again, like you hire directors and photographers and illustrators and stuff like that to bring something to the table. If I drew it out for them specifically as to what I wanted, then I'm wasting my money on bringing them to the table. So again, teaching the folks on my team that that's probably a pretty efficient way to work, I think helps breed them as leaders. And even for like the introverts, like I said, I can be a little bit of a loud mouth. I'm not afraid to speak up, but for some folks who maybe aren't, they can still make a really strong point and bring the information to the table and talk to the people who work for them in ways that that empower them and get good results. And for me, those are the main pieces of building strong leaders on my team.
I want to jump back a little bit more project-based now. I mean, you've done a ton of things over your career, obviously a lot of different types of work. Is there, you know, one project or one thing that stands out to you as your favorite, or is there a great story that stands out to you of a project that you worked on that might resonate with people?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to just do a blanket Super Bowl as an answer, but I remember being at the NFL on the early side, and we had like a weekly meeting for the creative team, and somebody came in and was showing off the style guide for the Super Bowl. And it was like, I don't know, 80 pages or something ridiculous. And I was like, I never want to do that. I don't, that scares the shit out of me. And, you know, X number of years later, I created a style guide for Super Bowl 51, and just the process in doing so and having that out there was super fulfilling, and I'm very proud of it. And then seeing it come to life and helping manage all of those pieces that were created, and the stadium and the ticket and the program cover and marks on the field and what have you, like it's pretty amazing. But I will say, if I can parlay that into sort of another Super Bowl moment, was then Super Bowl 54 was in Miami, and we'd really dug in deep on the research of we dig in on sort of the location that we are, the state of the league at that time. 51 especially was like, okay, we're coming off of Super Bowl 50. Like, who's going to care about 51? So you have to kind of think about where you are in that situation. But this was 54 in Miami. We had just come off of 53, obviously, in Minnesota, which is like totally different. How can we take this and how do we make it different? You know, all of these events, while for us, it's year after year after year, they're different for everybody. How do we keep it exciting and new and interesting? And we built a really beautiful style guide. And then 54 happened to be the culmination of our 100th season. And while it wasn't about the Super Bowl, because we had just done 50th Super Bowl, but it was the end of our celebration of our 100th season. How do we make that special? And so we engaged the people who run Wynwood Walls, which is a outdoor sort of art, street art museum in Miami, and Miami is well known for art and host of Art Basel and everything. How do we take that part of Miami culture and bring it into Super Bowl and bring it to life? It had a nice overlap with our audience, or at least, you know, some of our audience. But if we're looking at younger fans and we're looking at culturally relevant and we think about players and what they're into, it just seemed like a no-brainer. And so we created this whole platform around five different artists who brought individually curated custom pieces to the table that were ticket art, program cover, items around Miami that were significant of different football memories over the last 100 years, murals that folks could interact with at Super Bowl experience. I'm leaving something out. I don't recall what it was, but it just felt like a bigger moment. And it was, we used our big hits. This was part of our big hits, which in the past were really great, right? They were like huge light shows on a water background, or fireworks or light shows, whatever. They're cool, but they're in the moment. And these felt like they not only transcended Miami, but they transcended football. This was a art. And this was for somebody, you know, an art nerd, art, went to art school and like You're looking at people who do street art for a living, who are now creating 80-foot murals that are working in downtown Miami. And it was just like a, for me, just a really cool moment to see the convergence of art and sport and culture all kind of blowing up all at once and be successful too. Cause I was like, I have this idea and it became real. And it was, to me, that was my most proudest moment. So.
No, that's incredible. That sounds, I wish I could have seen that. I'll have to try and find some of those photos online, or I'm sure it's documented around. Yes, of course. We will.
And there was a New York Times article written about it, which was like, Mom, Dad, I made it. I'm in the Times. So, every designer, every creative, their parents are always like, what do you do again?
Oh, right? Gosh, yeah.
Like, but
yeah.
I'm in the New York Times, so.
Yeah.
Check.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, how much do you do that for every Super Bowl? I know, obviously, that sounded like kind of the big one and the, you know, right, the one that was special. But, you know, the Super Bowls, I think, sometimes get a, from a design standpoint, get a bad name just because the logo has become so consistent compared to, you know, back when it used to be logo for every city. And, but how much are you theming things around the city and around, you know, what's happening, you know, outside of the game beyond the logo? Cause you got to obviously take ownership of it from your design standpoint, sure, when you try and make it special for every city and every year.
Yeah. And I mean, the logo, it's a hot topic and definitely something that could be debated on and on and on. And
sure,
it did used to be that there was one sort of regional Super Bowl logo that showed the stadium and all like the flora and fauna of the area. And then one kind of global one that was just the mark and just the letters. And we wanted to try and elevate the brand of Super Bowl so that it was, you know, just one mark, you know, the Masters, the Olympics, what have you. A side of that was that the style guide for that Super Bowl would be what brings it to life. And the thing is, you can't focus on the game because you start work on development of the Super Bowl, just the theme of it or how that's going to come to life, color forecasting, et cetera, about 2 years ahead of time, because the Super Bowl style guide has to drop the day after the Super Bowl prior. So it's a year in which licensees and partners have to bring things to life for their purposes. If there's a partner that's putting together a sweepstakes, you could win tickets, yada, yada. They're going to have to start working on that way ahead of time. So you're putting out the style guide into the world for other people to utilize a year ahead of time, and spending about a year prior in development of that. So you know that there's going to be a game and that there will be football involved. And that's about all you can do from a football standpoint of bringing it to life. So you have to focus on, you know, you could never have known that COVID was going to happen and become a play a role in 55 last year. 55. So, you know, you work with what you know and what you can sort of assume. So we knew that 54 was the culmination of the 100th season. And so we wanted to elevate it, make it a little more special. And that's part of that, the project with the street artists, but really bringing in, we actually had five different concepts that we had played out in color palette, key art, graphic assets, patterns, photography styles, each one laid up on the wall in the studio, and each one bringing to life sort of a different aspect of Miami in a really great way and so authentically to the city, and that felt right for football. So much so that we share it all the way up through with the CMO and the head of events. And they were like, great, we don't know. Like, we can't really decide. They cut it down to three, which was kind of a good place to be, and actually nice that nobody was trying to Frankenstein anything together. But this was the one case where Mr. Ross, the owner of the Dolphins and the owner of Hard Rock Stadium, was going to be in town. And we presented to him because he was sort of the Miami expert. And this was his house where this was all happening. And he was the one who sort of said, yep, that's it. That's the one that feels the most like Miami. It was super elevated, super high end, fit with the image of Miami, but also when you were in the space and in Miami and in the stadium, it felt right for what it was. And it was not your down and dirty sports thinking. And I get, this is sort of like, I never planned to get into sports. This wasn't my style before. I would say this is an area where thinking of how do we elevate this? How do we make this look more premium? How do we take this to a level that doesn't feel necessarily rooted in sport, but rooted in culture? And that's how it came to life.
Molly, I want to get to asking you about being a female in sports design. You've worked at the NFL for over a decade and brought something new. And like you mentioned early on, when you were crediting your boss for seeing that your design could transcend what you were doing and working within the NFL. So I just wanted to get your perspective on working in the predominantly male field.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I will say the NFL does have a good mix of male and female. But I think you think of sports design, again, I don't know if it's a gender thing, but I don't think a lot of girls are sitting around thinking about how they're going to create logos for sports leagues when they grow up. But who knows, maybe. But it presented itself at a time where I was interested in a new challenge. And, you know, I think I kind of told myself, like, I got this. I could do sports design. No problem. And I didn't think fully through of like what that meant and sort of the learning curve and pieces like that. And so there's that piece. And I think that goes with any job where you're entering into a new sort of field. But again, I credit my boss for seeing that like good design and looking to, they wanted to elevate the brand. And I think my style of work had a little bit more of a premium feel to it to bring that to the forefront. I think that's important for anybody looking to get into any field of design. If you're playing at the top of your game, then you can probably get across to any genre or any field that you want to. And then being confident, holding your ground. I don't think you have to be a loudmouth like me necessarily. I don't know if loudmouth's the right one, but I'm assertive and not afraid to speak my mind. And I actually think having played sports growing up is something that helps a lot. And I think girls who play sports can really kind of learn the confidence level that they need to be in a place where they're like, no, I got this, or I'll take it on. I don't think that there's, like I said, a ring wall. Like, who knew? I'll take it on. I'll do it. I think staying confident and knowing that it's not about gender necessarily. It's just doing what you love, doing what you know you're good at, being open to failing and learning and doing a lot of learning is really helpful. And I don't know if that's necessarily for females over males for real, but it's a good lesson in general.
Yeah, that's what that was going to be my next question is if you're talking to females who are either just getting out of school or looking to enter the sports field and have played sports growing up and have a strong interest in wanting to get into the field, is there anything that you would tell them advice wise?
Try it. Right. Like there's no harm in, if you have an interest in it and you think you want to do it, get in there and don't let anything hold you back. I think that's kind of a sports mentality or at least an athlete mentality, right? Just,
for sure.
Just go for it.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of hokey, but it's true.
Is there anything else we missed, we didn't ask about that you want to talk about, or, you know, I want to make sure we covered everything that you want to hit on.
You know, something, you know, the ring wall was the first project and you get to a place like the NFL and you're like, I want to do team logos and I want to do this and that. And I had the opportunity to do that. And it was great. And I think some of the more challenging and rewarding things were some of the projects that I was like, oh, I got to work on this. And when it comes down to the decor for the new office or the Canada office, or as I was leaving, we were finishing decoring the office in LA, the Hollywood Park next to SoFi. And that's some of the coolest shit I did. You have the ability to translate the brand in ways that you probably never would, right? It's internal, but it's outward facing. You want to make fans happy, but you also want to make employees happy and you want them to be excited about the space that they're in. And so you have this opportunity to take the brand and really stretch it and really do cool things with it. And it's not just putting a poster on a wall, but it's things you kind of get nerdy about in school, printing techniques and paper dimensional things. How do you create like a, we created our own neon signs, things like that. It was awesome. And so I think noting that sometimes the projects you hate might end up being the best ones, right? Or the things that that seem like the most trouble, they may end up being the most rewarding. And that you have the opportunity, where you have the opportunity to do brand work that really stretches the imagination and your creativity level is just take it, do that always.
I love that. I didn't really get a sense from your website, some of the more tactical, or when you were talking about the Miami Super Bowl, like all the experiential design and different things that you were able to do, whether it's within space or at the Super Bowl. Do you see more design going that way?
Not right now, not during COVID. Yeah. But when it pops back up, yeah, I think so. And I think there are a lot of experiential agencies out there. And I don't know if maybe it's a New York thing, but all of like the different museums that pop up, like Color Museum, the Museum of Ice Cream, there's a Slime Institute, like where you have opportunities to engage. And again, knowing where we are in the world, who knows when we'll get back to it. But I think that people crave interaction and in the same time, selfie spaces or Instagrammable moments. So you want to create these spaces that are just super cool. And we had that ability at NFL to create dimensional signage, that, like the perpetual art kind of thing that you have to be at a certain angle to see different things, or even like store design and things like that. If you think about Nike stores, what do mannequins look like? I don't know. You just, especially when you have fans or consumers engaging in your product, in you want to engage them in your product in new ways, and you have to find different experiences for them to navigate, or else you're losing interest. And I think that's where the disruption comes in. You just want to give somebody something that they haven't seen or experienced before. But we got to get out of COVID first.
Amen.
Yeah.
Hopefully sooner than later, but
yes, I know it doesn't seem like it right now, but
no, it does not.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.